This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Today's topic is the exciting work that's being done at the Shiley Eye Institute and the Viterbi Family Department of Ophthalmology at UC San Diego. And I'd like to start by welcoming the two people whose names I just mentioned, who are in the audience today, Darlene Shiley and Dr. Andrew Viterbi. Their generosity has made ophthalmology at UC San Diego the amazing place it is today. We're the only academic eye center in the region. We provide the most advanced care to help prevent, treat, and cure eye disease. Our research is driving innovative new methods to diagnose and treat eye disease and its disorders. And in addition to training future ophthalmologists, we're committed to serving the San Diego community and contributing to advancements in vision care on a global scale. But to start this off, I have a special treat. Dr. Michael Drake is going to give us an introduction. He is the 21st president of the University of California in August. And it's particularly appropriate for this health talk because he is an ophthalmologist. Sorry. He received his education at Stanford and then at UC San Francisco, and finally advanced fellowship at Massachusetts Eye and Ear. Before coming back to the University of California, he was the president of the Ohio State University from 2014 through 2020, and then he came back to be our president. And preceding that, he was the chancellor at UC Irvine, and before that, he was the vice president for health affairs of the entire UC system. So I would now like to introduce President Michael Drake.
Hello, I'm President Michael Drake, and I'm proud to welcome you to today's Health Talks conversation, highlighting the Shiley Eye Institute and the Viterbi Family Department of Ophthalmology at UC San Diego. As a UC-trained ophthalmologist myself, this work is very close to my heart. I received my MD degree and did my residency training and fellowship in ophthalmology at UCSF and was a member of the faculty for more than two decades. I also served as the system-wide vice president for UC Health Affairs for 5 years, and I've always been very proud to be part of a health system so committed to improving the lives of patients and to making pioneering discoveries in this field broadly. The Shiley Eye Institute and the Viterbi Family Department of Ophthalmology exemplify UC's dedication to cutting-edge research and outstanding patient care. Shiley Eye Institute is the only academic vision center in the San Diego area with comprehensive programs for the clinical care of patients with eye disorders. The Institute is also developing dynamic new surgical techniques and treatments for eye diseases while conducting innovative outreach to the community through services like the Shiley Eye Mobile. Under the leadership of Dr. Robert Weinreb, the Institute continues to shape the future of vision care in California and around the world. During my own training and work as an ophthalmologist, I've met many colleagues who turned out to be distinguished leaders nationally and internationally. One of them is Dr. Weinreb, who I've known since we both finished our schooling. We've been friends and colleagues for many decades, and I'm proud to see his incredible leadership and the work that he's done at the Shiley Eye Institute over all of these years. Meanwhile, the Viterbi Family Department of Ophthalmology offers the most advanced treatments across all areas of eye disease and vision care. Every day, the department's world-class clinicians, surgeons, scientists, and staff provide culturally sensitive care to UC patients from all backgrounds while also pursuing life-changing cures. Today's discussion will highlight these two institutions that have improved the lives of countless patients who suffer from eye disease and vision loss. On behalf of myself and my colleagues at UC San Diego, thank you for joining us.
Okay, now it's my pleasure to introduce my my colleague and friend, Dr. Robert Weinreb. Dr. Weinreb is the chair and distinguished professor of the Viterbi Family Department of Ophthalmology at UC San Diego, as well as director of both the Shiley Eye Institute and the Hamilton Glaucoma Center. He holds the Morris Gletsch MD Chair of Glaucoma, and also is appointed a distinguished professor of bioengineering. He is a graduate of Harvard Medical School and of UC San Francisco in residency and fellowship. Dr. Weinrab is a clinician, a surgeon, and a scientist. He has been continually supported for his research by the National Institutes of Health since his residency. His interests in vision research are diverse and range from the front to the back of the eye. He has served as president of several major organizations and has received recognition with many awards. In 2020, he was again ranked by ExpertScape as the world's leading expert in glaucoma. He has over 150 postdoctoral fellows who he's trained, and they have gone on to be chairs and distinguished academicians throughout the United States and the world. In 2019, UC San Diego Health Sciences recognized Dr. Weinrab with its Faculty Excellence and Mentoring Award. Bob, thank you.
Thanks, David, and thanks for the invitation to share our vision for the Shiley Eye Institute and UCSD ophthalmology this afternoon. And greetings to everyone. Well, we began in 1983. We were part of the Department of Surgery, and it was at that time we became a department. We had a small clinic in UCSD Medical Center in Hillcrest. In 1984, we opened even a smaller clinic with four examining lanes on the campus at UCSD. In the late 1980s, we partnered with Darlene and the late Donald Shiley to bring great vision care to the people of San Diego. They also understood that our vision research could impact the lives of countless individuals throughout the world. And through their donation, we opened in April of 1991, the Shiley Eye Center. I moved in a few months earlier. I was surrounded by coyotes and rabbits, as the Shiley Eye Center was the first building on the East Campus at UCSD. Today, the Shiley Eye Institute consists of the Shiley Eye Center, and through the generosity of grateful patients and donors, we opened the Jacobs Retina Center, the Hamilton Glaucoma Center, the Ratner Children's Eye Center, and we have an iMobile that provides free screening and spectacles to the children of San Diego in some of the underserved areas. In August of 2018, we had a transformative gift from Andrew Viterbi that provided six endowed chairs as well as funds to construct a vision research center that will be part of the Shiley Eye Institute complex. Many thanks to our chancellor, Pradeep Khosla, and our vice chancellor, David Brenner, for their continued support from the inception of this gift to the current time. Incidentally, the first of the endowed chairs is named in honor of Andrew Viterbi's father, Achilles Viterbi, an ophthalmologist who practiced in Italy and subsequently in Boston. Today, we consist of 30 clinicians. We have residents, fellows, we have full-time vision scientists, and many of our clinicians are also clinician scientists. We have more than 250 staff. Even during this tumultuous year, we examined more than 100,000 patients, and we performed about 5,000 surgeries. Our patients come from throughout San Diego, Southern California, from throughout the country, and from throughout the world. Our alumni also are positioned throughout the United States and throughout the world. Well, let me share four of our visions. First, we focus our resources and energy on developing programs that position the Shiley Eye Institute as a world leader. In our clinical practices, we do this through subspecialties like retina, cornea, glaucoma, oculoplastics, pediatric ophthalmology, for example. Second, we leverage a multidisciplinary approach to treat, prevent, and cure blindness. We're grateful for the scientists throughout the campus of UCSD who have partnered with us in this endeavor. Our impact is great. When this was measured, as determined by the H index, a factor that looks at the impact of publications, we ranked second in the nation. Third, we invest in state-of-the-art facilities, equipment, and most of all, brain power. Our programs are significant. First and foremost, we have the Richard C. Atkinson Laboratory for Regenerative Ophthalmology. The goal is to rescue and restore vision in glaucoma, retinal degenerations, and corneal disease, and we're making considerable progress in each of these. We established a biobank several years ago. We have thousands of DNA samples that were obtained from blood samples from our patients at the Shiley Eye Institute. And this information allows us to identify causative genetic variants. And we can also identify those patients that might be suitable for gene therapy trials. During the past year, we opened a retinal degeneration clinic, and we're using that information to actually perform trials of gene therapy. Genetic testing today has improved to the point that we can now identify causative disease-causing variants in up to 75% of patients with retinal degeneration. And in the very near future, we'll be doing the same with patients with glaucoma. We have several ongoing trials of gene augmenting therapy that are being tested today in this clinic. In fact, one of the first patients in the entire United States that was treated is a Shiley Eye Institute patient. We hope to be opening a diabetes eye clinic that will provide great care to the children and adults with diabetes. Diabetic retinopathy is the leading cause of morbidity in patients with diabetes, and we hope to be integrating this care throughout UCSD Health and the other specialties that also care for patients with diabetes. We've trained more than 21 department chairs. We've trained editors and leaders throughout ophthalmology and throughout the world. And fourth and finally, and most importantly, we deliver the finest eye care to the residents of San Diego. And this was nowhere more apparent during the past tumultuous year when our operating room staff, our clinic staff, our vision scientists all stepped forward to provide great care that was safe and effective to our patients. Incidentally, our iMobile was converted into a triage unit for COVID-19. If you're interested in learning more about our activities, our annual report for 2020 is available. Today, I wanted to focus on some of the faculty that have joined us over the past several years. And we have three outstanding physician scientists. And right at the top of the list is Dr. Sally Baxter, who is our newest faculty member. She's an assistant professor of ophthalmology at UCSD. And she's a San Diego native who's a former valedictorian at Rancho Bernardo High School. She attended Duke University and incidentally was a champion pole vaulter at Duke. She then was selected by the British government to receive a United States Marshall Scholarship for a Master's of Science in Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She obtained her medical degree at the University of Pennsylvania, and we're very proud to have trained her here in ophthalmology during her residency. And she was a postdoctoral fellow also at UCSD in biomedical informatics. And most recently, Sally was a 2020 recipient of the National Institutes of Health Director's Award for Early Independence, which is a very prestigious grant that's awarded to only 13 promising young scientists across the country with high potential for performing cross-cutting, high impact research, and her clinical and research interests include informatics applications in ophthalmology, predictive modeling using big data analytics, integration of health information technology into clinical workflows, and medical education. Sally?
It's my great pleasure to be here and to share some of my work on developing digital tools to help patients take their medications. First, I want to give a little bit of background about glaucoma, which is the condition we are trying to address. Glaucoma is the world's leading cause of irreversible blindness. It is caused by progressive damage to the optic nerve, which is a structure that connects the eye and to the brain. And when that happens, the patients can lose visual field, as is shown in this picture. The optic nerve is a pressure-sensitive structure, and because eye pressure has been shown to be a key risk factor for developing glaucoma or for worsening glaucoma, our treatments are primarily aimed at lowering eye pressure. And while we can do that with laser procedures and surgical interventions, the most common first-line therapy for reducing eye pressure is the use of topical eye drops. Many of our patients have to use eye drops daily or multiple times daily over the course of many years in order to control their eye pressure and to reduce their risk of becoming blind from glaucoma. So for glaucoma, regular and consistent use of medications is critically important. This is a picture of Hippocrates. He's a Greek physician who's often considered the father of medicine. And back in 400 BC, he was the first to note that some patients did not take their medications as prescribed and then later complained that their treatment did not help them. More recently, our former U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. C. Everett Koop, put it rather bluntly that drugs don't work in patients who don't take them. Now, this is not just an issue for patients with glaucoma, but rather for chronic disease management more generally. We have an increasing number of people who have chronic diseases and have to take medications on a regular basis over the course of many years. Reduced adherence or reduced ability to take those medications consistently as prescribed results in poor health outcomes and massive healthcare costs. Reasons for non-adherence include forgetfulness, medication costs, side effects, and doubts that the medications are actually working for them. To further complicate things, patients may overreport their own medication adherence. And oftentimes, this is not a conscious decision to deceive or anything like that, but many patients simply can't remember how often they took a certain medication. Often they're having to balance many different medications in a complex regimen. Sometimes they may not want to disappoint their physician. But either way, it can be really tough for us as healthcare providers to know which patients might be struggling to take their medications. And therefore, we don't often know who we need to do additional outreach to help support them. And so the idea for our work has been to use technology to, one, measure adherence more accurately, and two, better engage patients to improve adherence. And so as part of this work, I've been very fortunate to work with a multidisciplinary team of experts across UC San Diego. And we're working on flexible electronic sensor technology that can be wrapped around an eyedrop bottle with specialized circuitry and components to be able to tell when that eyedrop bottle has been inverted in the correct direction, when sufficient force has been applied, and therefore can tell us when a medication dose has been given and register that on a mobile app. And with this technology, we would be able to help track which patients might be missing medication doses, taking medications too frequently, or taking their medications on a schedule that doesn't align with what their doctor prescribed. And our hope would be that when we see that a medication has been missed or given incorrectly, we can provide real-time feedback to help remind the patient and to help them in their quest to have adherence to the prescribed regimen. We've done a lot of work in the laboratory to validate the technology. And if you're interested in more details, the full link is here. It is available to the public on PubMed Central, and I'll include it in the Q&A chat box as well. Also very excitingly, Dr. Weinreb and Dr. Coleman, members and leaders of our team, have co-founded a company, Torimedes, to further develop and apply this technology. And now our whole team is very excited to enter the early phases of deployment of this technology to patients and be able to validate it in real-world settings. Our goal is to leverage these technological advances to reduce disparities and improve outcomes. And we're particularly interested in vulnerable populations such as older adults and minorities who carry a disproportionate burden of glaucoma and glaucoma-related blindness. I'd like to close the talk with a quote from the World Health Organization, who said, "Increasing the effectiveness of adherence interventions may have a far greater impact on the health of the population than any improvement in specific medical treatments." I hope I've conveyed the importance of this problem, and I'm very excited to be working with such a great team at UCSD to make advances toward tackling this challenge and helping our patients. I thank you so much for your time and attention.
Well, thanks, Sally. That was just great. And again, I want to acknowledge some of the team members, Lucila Ono Machado, Camille Nebica at UCSD. And also I want to mention that this was a project that we started with support from a donor, Erwin Zahn, and it small donation allowed us to initiate the project and build it and to a point where we have NIH funding soon. I'm going to introduce Dr. Eric Noodleman, our next speaker. He's an associate professor of ophthalmology at UCSD, and like Dr. Baxter, he's an NIH-supported clinician scientist. Eric specializes in vitreoretinal diseases and surgery, and he's focused on retinal vasculature, particularly diabetic retinopathy. In addition, he has subspecialty interest in training in pediatric retinal diseases. He's one of the few specialists in the country who can take care of children who have retinal problems and can perform surgery on the children. He cares for infants and children at UCSD and Rady Children's Hospital, and his laboratory is working on developing novel therapies that target abnormalities of retinal vessels and associated scar tissue formation. Eric?
Thank you very much for the introduction, Dr. Weinreb. It's a great pleasure to participate in this seminar series and to discuss the present and future of diabetic retinopathy. So this is not a COVID map, but this is data regarding a different epidemic. Diabetic retinopathy has been rapidly on the rise in the United States in the last several decades, now totaling almost 35 million Americans that are affected, which is about 1 in 10 people. Currently, roughly one-fifth are undiagnosed. So clearly this is an enormous issue for the American healthcare system, and similar numbers are being seen around the world. It's important to keep in mind that diabetes is a systemic disease and it affects nearly every organ in the body. Some of the most common effects are highlighted here: stroke, heart disease, kidney disease, and peripheral neuropathy. As a result, patients with diabetes require coordination of multiple specialists, which can be complex and confusing for patients. In the eye, diabetes has several key complications, including increased risk of cataract at a young age, glaucoma, and diabetic retinopathy, which affects approximately one-third of patients with diabetes. In fact, diabetic retinopathy is the leading cause of blindness for adults in the working age population. The main risk factor for how an eye changes from the image on the left to the image on the right is the duration of diabetes, which is why young people that are diagnosed are at such high risk. Of course, poor control of diabetes is also a risk, and every 1% increase in hemoglobin A1C levels corresponds to a 50% increased risk of vision loss due to diabetic retinopathy. Now, this does not happen all at once. It goes through stages. We classify diabetic retinopathy as non-proliferative, which refers to leakage from blood vessels of blood and lipid, proliferative, which refers to the growth of abnormal blood vessels, which you see off the optic nerve here, fibrotic, which is the contraction of those abnormal blood vessels, and ultimately tractional, which is the pulling of those fibrotic tissue on the retinal surface, causing a retinal detachment. The most common reason for vision loss in patients with diabetic retinopathy is called macular edema. On the left, you see a cross-section of a normal macula, which is the anatomic location responsible for seeing detail. In the disease, you see that there is leakage from abnormal blood vessels causing these cysts to develop. These cysts cause swelling in the retina, which blurs the vision. About 20 years ago, Dr. Ferrara, Napoleon Ferrara, made a landmark discovery that fundamentally changed how we manage diabetic retinopathy. We're very fortunate to have Napoleon Ferrara at UCSD, and I'm personally very lucky to work closely with him and to share several grants. Dr. Ferrara discovered a key molecule that is secreted by tissues in need of a blood supply, such as tumors. This molecule, called vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF, is produced at high levels in eyes with diabetic retinopathy, which causes blood vessels in the retina to leak and proliferate. It wasn't long till inhibitors of this molecule were developed. These drugs, called anti-VEGFs, are profoundly effective. They're given as injections in the eye. They can not only improve vision in eyes with diabetic macular edema, as shown here from this seminal study, but can halt the progression to later stages of the disease. These drugs are blockbusters, with more than 12 million injections a year for diabetic macular edema in the United States. The benefit that they have provided cannot be overstated. Simply, they have saved millions of people from blindness worldwide. The downside is that the injections need to be given roughly monthly, which is not only costly, $6.4 billion a year in the US, but is extremely taxing on the patients, providers, and the workforce. Anti-VEGF therapies also do an excellent job at preventing and regressing proliferative retinopathy. But when the neovascularization is too advanced, scar tissue that contracts, such shown here, can detach the retina, shown here in cross-section. The only intervention at this point is surgical to remove the fibrotic tissue. But these cases are challenging and the outcomes are often poor. This is really an unmet need. We believe that a dedicated diabetes eye clinic is going to help prevent blindness. Why? Well, this is a preventable disease, and early diagnosis allows for early treatment. We have great drugs now. The key is catching it. Having a dedicated clinic will improve integration with other services and allow us to provide all the necessary services and equipment to catch the disease early and prevent progression. And finally, a diabetes eye clinic will allow us to expand our research efforts, particularly those that translate basic science discoveries to clinical care. Thank you very much.
Well, that was just fantastic, Eric. You know, one thing that is worth mentioning is the transformative work that Eric is performing with Napoleon Ferrara has application not only to diabetes, but also to macular degeneration. And that's something that they're definitely following up on. Our third speaker today is Derek Welsby. Derek is another physician scientist. He's an associate professor of ophthalmology and a specialist in glaucoma. Derek earned his MD and PhD in molecular biology at UCLA. And while he was there, he did pioneering work in cancer. In fact, he's co-inventor of Xtandi, which is now the standard of care for advanced prostate cancer. And fortunately, he's turned his attention to glaucoma, and he's hot in pursuit of a drug that also will become standard of care for glaucoma. Dr. Welsby completed a residency and fellowship in ophthalmology at the Wilmer Eye Institute at Johns Hopkins, and his laboratory studies the way in which glaucoma leads to optic nerve injury and vision loss. He uses high-throughput genetic screening to characterize the genes responsible for optic nerve cell death and degeneration. And we've actually done that with some of our patients. And he's currently working to develop drugs that improve optic nerve cell survival and preserve vision in glaucoma. His work has been published in high-impact journals like Nature And he has a very important manuscript that soon will be published in the proceedings of the National Academy of Science. So we welcome Derek Welsby to us today. Derek?
Good afternoon. I'm Derek Welsby, an associate professor in the Viterbi Department of Ophthalmology. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you about vision restoration research happening at the Shiley Eye Institute. Let's begin with some background. The eye focuses light onto a tissue called the retina. If we use the analogy of a camera, the retina is like the film. And it's composed of many types of cells, one of which is an optic nerve cell. It has a long fiber that connects that point of the retina to the brain. Now I'm showing one cell. In reality, there are about 1 million cells lining the entire retina, with each one representing a pixel of your vision. Visual information is processed by the retina, transmitted via the optic nerve to the brain, where we experience vision. So what happens in glaucoma? Here's an actual photo of a retina, as your ophthalmologist would see when he or she examines your eye, overlaid with a cartoon showing 12 optic nerve cells, and the visual field seen by a patient. In glaucoma, these optic nerve cells get damaged. The cells degenerate and die, and portions of the retina become disconnected from the brain, leading to vision loss. This continues to spread, and patients lose more and more vision. And sadly, for some, this can lead to total blindness. And in 2020, all of our treatments, including surgery, laser, and eye drops, all center around lowering eye pressure. And yet, 50% of patients never have an elevated eye pressure, and some patients continue to worsen despite lowering eye pressure. And finally, because these are optic nerve cells, once they die, they don't come back. This vision loss is permanent, and we don't have therapies currently to restore vision. With over 80 million affected, glaucoma is a leading reason people in the world go irreversibly blind. So our challenges are to develop new therapies to protect the cells that we have and to replace the cells that we've lost. Obviously, it would be best to study optic nerve cells from patients, but we can't do that without blinding the person. So the idea was to generate optic nerve cells from patients using stem cells. Amit Patel, a postdoc in my lab, worked with Dr. Carl Vollen, one of our faculty, who's an expert in stem cell technology. First, we isolate blood from glaucoma patients, turn that into stem cells, and then genetically modify the stem cells so that if they turn into optic nerve cells, they turn red. We give the stem cells the instructions to turn into retina. That ball right there is not an eyeball. It's actually a stem cell-derived retina grown in a dish. And it's starting to make optic nerve cells, which are those red dots. We can then purify the optic nerve cells, injure them as they're injured in glaucoma, and place them into little plates that have thousands of wells, as shown here. If I do nothing, they all die because they're injured optic nerve cells, and that's what happens, just like in glaucoma. So what we do first is add various drugs to each of the wells, as shown. We then use a robotic microscope to image the wells, and image analysis software to count the number of surviving optic nerve cells. Any well that has surviving cells indicates that a protective drug was added there, and that's a potential new therapy. And we usually don't just find one, we find many. So we can use artificial intelligence to try to understand the patterns and the underlying reason why the optic nerve cells are dying or failing to regenerate their fiber. Prior to this work, there were strategies to keep optic nerve cells alive, but they wouldn't regenerate. Or we could get them to regenerate, but they wouldn't live very long. Using the screening technology I just described, our lab was able to identify the first class of drugs that both improves optic nerve cell survival and promotes regeneration of the fibers. While we're using stem cells to try to model human disease, my colleague, Dr. Jean Doe, is using stem cells as a potential therapy to restore vision. Working with Dr. Mark Tyshinsky, who has done pioneering work on spinal cord regeneration, they had an idea for reconnecting the damaged optic nerve. By implanting stem cells directly into the optic nerve in order to generate a relay that would reconnect the optic nerve and potentially restore vision. Dr. Doe has already demonstrated that this might be possible. On the top, shown in green, are injured optic nerve cells. You can see that their green fibers that are injured stop at that white line where the injury site is. In contrast, on the bottom, he has implanted stem cells to create a relay, shown in red. And if we continue to the right, we can see robust regeneration of the optic nerve all the way back to the brain. So in conclusion, I've shown how stem cells are being used, both as a way to model the disease and discover new drugs, and also as a therapy for vision restoration. Of course, I want to thank the people in my lab and acknowledge the people who actually do all the work, our funding sources, and our generous patients. Thank you very much.
That was just great, Derek. David Brenner is going to host a group of questions now. And again, thank you to the speakers. And of course, they are representative of the outstanding clinician scientists within the department and the Shiley Eye Institute. And a big thanks also, again, to Darlene Shiley and to Andrew Viterbi for everything that you're doing and making this happen. David?
Thank you. I've started off with a large number of questions, some general, some very specific. And here, I think it's a good one for Sally. You ready?
Sure.
Thank you. So is it safe to have eye exams during COVID-19?
Yeah, well, I'm sure this is a very pressing question, especially now as the pandemic carries on and the number of cases are going up. I would say that any type of human interaction carries some risk of transmission, but that an eye exam, especially here at the Shiley Eye Institute, we have so many different safeguards in place to reduce the risk of COVID transmission as much as possible. This includes symptom screening at the front door, regular COVID testing of both patients and our care providers. We've installed plexiglass dividers on all of our slit lamps. We have everyone wearing personal protective equipment, like masks, gloves, and the like. And so I think with that all considered, that there are numerous precautions being taken to make sure that eye exams are as safe as possible and that we can still take care of your vision even during these challenging times.
Fantastic. Let me ask a follow-up question. Which of your patients coming into the Shiley Eye Institute are screened for COVID-19? If they're going to have surgery, are they screened? If they're
yes. an eye exam, are they screened? Every patient who comes through our doors undergoes a symptom screening, and that applies to all of our employees as well. And then all of the patients who are scheduled for surgery do get COVID-19 testing and are confirmed negative before they can proceed with surgery.
Very good. Thank you. What does the future, the near future, hold for treatment for glaucoma?
Actually, that was one of the reasons I became a glaucoma specialist, was because this field is advancing so much so quickly. So I think the big advances will be in things like neuroprotection, which we obviously discussed, but also how eye drops are administered, where it's not a drop every day, but there'll be sustained release, how pressure is monitored in patients, and in new innovative surgeries that are much less invasive to the eye. All of these things are happening right now.
Very good. And I think this one's good for Eric. if you get stuck, you can always stick it to WineRab. So he's like our default person. Okay. But I think this one's good for you. So are there any new treatments for macular degeneration on the horizon?
Yeah, absolutely. As Dr. Weinreb mentioned at the end of my presentation, the drugs that we're developing apply to macular degeneration as well. So the big effort right now in AMD is for wet AMD is longer lasting drugs that can be given less frequently with more durability. So we're working on that and hope to have a drug that can be injected every 6 months or every year or even less time. The other component of macular degeneration, dry macular degeneration, at this point is an unmet need. And there's a tremendous amount of work being done by all the big pharmaceutical companies to try to develop some therapy for dry AMD. And there has been some progress. There's also been some failures. Right now, there is not an approved drug for dry AMD, but we do expect meaningful progress in the next handful of years.
Can you say where Avastin fits into that?
Avastin is a drug that is for wet AMD. It's actually a chemotherapeutic. It's not approved for treatment in the eye. It's an inhibitor of angiogenesis, just like the other drugs that I mentioned, Eylea and Lucentis. It was developed by Genentech and was the first product developed by Genentech with Napoleon Ferrara there. So it's extremely valuable for us. We use it for all vascular diseases in the eye. So not just macular degeneration, but diabetic retinopathy, retinal vein occlusions, retinopathy prematurity in infants. It's really extremely powerful and useful drug, but it's not approved for anything in the eye since it's used off label.
Very good. Okay, there are a lot of questions that are coming up. So let me just try to field them. Here, any guess on when we can possibly see stem cell regeneration used on patients?
My guess is that we're looking at a staged approach. The first way we'll see these novel therapies is to preserve the cells you have. That'll be in the next, 3 to 5 year timeline. And I would say stem cells to actually regenerate the optic nerve, you're probably looking at beyond that, like a 10-year horizon.
Do you want to say something? Or else, Bob or I could say something about the approval of the next 10 years for California Institute for Regenerative Medicine and what the hope would be to be able to do additional research in stem cell research, particularly for blindness, optic nerves.
Yeah, let me just say that we're very excited by that. And we already met as a team to discuss submitting some proposals for both glaucoma and for macular degeneration. The types of proposals are going to be from the laboratory into the clinic, translate the research that we do in the laboratory and take it into the clinic. Dr. Welsby, Dr. Noodleman, Dr. Wallen are all people who are engaged in this, and it offers tremendous potential to bring to everyone in California the latest laboratory advances and translate them into things that will restore vision and possibly even cure disease.
Yeah, so we're all very excited. Here's a good one for either Bob or Eric. It says a regular optometry check up includes a glaucoma check. Is that only measuring eye pressure? If not all glaucoma patients have elevated pressure, how do you know that they do not have glaucoma?
Well,
I thought it was a good question. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's a great question because, when I was a resident, glaucoma was diagnosed with something we call the rule of 21. If your pressure was 21 or above, you had glaucoma and you were treated. And if it was below, you didn't have it. And as Derek mentioned in his lecture, a large number of our patients, maybe as many as half of our patients with glaucoma don't have high pressure. So we focus on the optic nerve. We focus on the function with visual field testing, and we focus on the actual structure of the optic nerve. And the work that Derek Welsby and his team is performing is addressed to the neurodegeneration or the deterioration of the optic nerve and not so much the intraocular pressure. And that's where the breakthroughs are going to come.
Thank you. Here's one, maybe for Sally, see if you like it. This is asking about the relationship between COVID-19 and eye problems. It says a lot of the patients have severe photophobia. And do we know anything about that?
Yeah, I see the question about, I think specifically about myalgic encephalomyelitis.
Yes, very good. That many of them thank you.
Really photophobic and light sensitive. I do think that this has been described not only in patients with myalgic encephalomyelitis, but also in traumatic brain injury as well. And there are many entities for which there are patients who have photophobia and light sensitivity, and we aren't necessarily able to detect inflammatory cells or obvious inflammation inside the eye. So the thought for this entity that the person has asked, Mr. Kemenzin, on chronic fatigue syndrome and that spectrum of disease, I think a lot of people are thinking it goes on more in the brain. I'm not personally aware of anyone at UCSD in our department who's working on neuroinflammation, but I defer to Dr. Weinreb on that question, as he can knows the entire array of work being done in the department.
Well, I'm glad, Sally, that you were asked that question because that's a tough one. And it is, you know, again, we don't know the origin of it, whether it's eye related, whether it's brain related, and we do not have anybody working on that.
Here's another glaucoma question. It says either for Bob or Eric. Typically, how many SLT procedures can be done before they are no longer effective? And then what's next? Reduce pressure. And then there was another question that's related, very similar by another person, what's the relation between SLT procedures or using eye drops?
Well, SLT stands for selective laser trabeculoplasty. And with this procedure, light is directed at the drain of the eye called the trabecular meshwork, to increase the amount of fluid leaving the eye. And it's moderately effective. In the past, it was used when medications did not work or could not be tolerated. And more recently, it's being used very early, sometimes even before eye drops have started. SLT can be done more than once. There's now publications that say that repeating it can sometimes work, particularly if it worked the first time and then the effect wore off. Too much of it, though, will actually have the opposite effect. It will raise the pressure and worsen the glaucoma.
Is it commonly done at UCSD?
It's something that, I'm sure Derek does in his clinic. And today I saw patients, and I did several this morning.
Next question is a question about genetics. About the genetics of dry AMD and of wet AMD.
Sure. So genetics are certainly a factor in macular degeneration. Macular degeneration is always a disease that progresses from dry to wet. So dry always precedes wet macular degeneration. The question about genetics is really important. There was a lot of effort to try to identify genetic risk factors, but there are some, but it's not exclusively a genetic disease. There's also environmental factors as well as age, which is the most important component.
Thank you. Here's actually one for me, so you guys can relax. This is from David Winkler, and it says Dr. Brenner, so that's how I know it's for me. By when do you anticipate UCSD will have a fully integrated diabetes care center to integrate with the Shalley Eye Institute and other diabetes-related specialties? And I thank David for pointing that out. He's absolutely correct. We do not have one yet. We were very far along in the planning before COVID-19 hit. And the concept to me is really important, to identify a subspecialist in every field who wants to be an expert in diabetic complications. Whether it's ophthalmology with you guys or cardiology or nephrology, in each case to have someone whose real expertise is in the clinical care of diabetic patients and in doing translational research to improve it. And we want it to be patient friendly. We want it to be one-stop shopping where the physicians come to the patient rather than the patient having to go all throughout the academic medical center to find the appropriate doctors. So that is very high on our list of things to do. And I think it's one of the things that we could do at UC San Diego, because we have an integrated healthcare system, that is very, very difficult to do in the community. So I think it's something we really can do to contribute to the care of San Diego. And David Winkler and I are old friends, so he's allowed to ask me hard questions. Okay. Here's, I think we answered this, but just in case we didn't, this is another glaucoma question about when eye drops are no longer effective. What's the next step? Because you already convinced me that SLT is not good. So what's the next step?
For patients where eye drops are no longer working, and sometimes that it really just requires a conversation about compliance and using the eye drops.
Okay. Yeah.
But for those where we can't do that, and laser is not an option, then we're talking about incisional surgery, like actually going to the operating room for cutting and sewing surgery. And there are actually quite a few different operations we can do now. And that repertoire has expanded quite a bit, I would say, in the last 5-10 years. So for those patients who don't respond to eye drops, there are still options.
Very good. This has not been discussed, but it's actually a problem that many of my colleagues have. So I'm very interested in the answer. And that is about retinal detachments. And an anonymous person said, I've had 13. And is there anything, any progress in treating and preventing retinal detachments? I don't know who should handle this. So I'll leave it up to
$50. I fixed retinal detachments, and 13 surgeries is a lot for sure. Retinal detachments are still a surgical disease or a surgical problem. But there's been a lot of progress in how we operate on them. We have much better instruments than we did even 10 years ago. The machines are constantly improving. Our visualization is improving and our outcomes are improving. So there's been a lot of progress, but there's not really progress in preventing retinal detachments. One major focus of research, though, is in neuroprotection, because when the retina is detached, you lose neural function. And if Derek is successful in providing us a drug for neuroprotection, it will certainly be valuable in preserving vision in patients with retinal detachments as well.
Okay. All right. I don't know what this is, so I hope this is interesting. I assume it's for Derek or Robert. It says, how applicable is the optic nerve research in glaucoma to NAION?
So
I hope that's nothing obscene, because I don't know what that means.
No, actually, the overlap is tremendous.
You have to say what that is first.
So it's essentially a stroke of your optic nerve.
Okay, thank you.
And, it's that same optic nerve cell that is damaged in so many different ways, including a stroke, glaucoma, trauma, and all these different mechanisms of injury. We give them different names. They're different diseases. But they have that same cell and the same response. And so it's actually very fortunate that when we study glaucoma, we can actually find therapies for these other various, what we call optic neuropathies. And it actually turns out to expand even beyond that these optic nerve cells, they're nerve cells. So some of the same programs that these cells are using to die are the same ones used by brain cells in Parkinson's or in Alzheimer's. And so it really, the overlap between these various neurodegenerative diseases is tremendous.
Very good. Here's one from Georgia Sadler, probably good for Sally or anyone. Are you recruiting participants to your studies as quickly as you would like? And how can the public learn about what studies are being conducted at UC San Diego?
Yeah, so I did put a comment there, but
you did. Oh, you're so good. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
I want to know the answer too.
Answer it live as well. With COVID-19, there have been some restrictions around research and the number of participants that we can safely have at one time for our research studies that are being conducted on site with in-person visits. And so, certainly, as with everything else in life, COVID-19 has affected our frequency and volume of research visits. That being said, research is still very active in our department, and many of our studies are continuing to proceed. Our website, which is shileyeye.ucsd.edu, includes information about the various research laboratories and several of the studies that are going on. If you're a patient at Shiley, you can always ask, your ophthalmologist or optometrist or provider for more information about the research studies as well, because not all of them are on the website. So those are some of the ways you can get information about the research studies.
Thank you so much. Okay. One last question this is a very common one. What, if anything, can be done about floaters?
Floaters. So floaters are a real common problem, very bothersome. We see lots of patients coming in with acute floaters. So the good news about floaters is they typically happen acutely because of a separation of the vitreous from the retinal surface. Oh. They're very bothersome early on in the first month or so, but they become less bothersome as the vitreous pulls further away from the retina and no longer casts as obvious of a shadow. So most of the time, after about 6 months, patients are not bothered by floaters. So the best thing to do about them is, number one, when you have them acutely, see an ophthalmologist. It's extremely important because the symptoms of floaters are the same as a symptom of a retinal tear, which precedes a retinal detachment. So you need to know if you have a tear, so it could be treated to prevent a detachment. It'll have to be seen. That's most important. And secondly, please wait. There are a lot of information online about treating floaters with lasers or even doing surgery for floaters. And most of the time, that is not necessary. Just waiting is the safest thing to do.
That's fantastic. All right, I'm going to end with a quote from Darlene Shiley, who just put into the chat here. So I'm going to read this to you. Darlene Shiley here. I am so pleased to be joining all of you in being updated on the incredible accomplishments of all the clinics and research centers that constitute the Shiley Eye Institute. This institute was my late husband Donald's favorite project and one of our first ventures into major philanthropy. I do so wish we were all gathered together so I could look at your faces and thank you for your support of all the doctors, scientists, nurses, and staff are doing on a daily basis. Thank you with great sincerity. That's a nice way to end. I want to thank my panel, and you guys did a great job. And I want to thank the 100, we're up to 150 participants who are participating in this. So there is a silver lining. You get to interact with people at a much higher number than you could if you all had to drive in to the Shiley Eye Institute to meet in person. So thank you all, and have a good evening. Good night now.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.